All right. Well, I'm the kind of person that really believes in the axiom that misery loves company. I've said this before in my class on Sunday mornings. And so when I come under great conviction, I feel it's my duty to have you share in that conviction. I need you to feel bad with me. And so this is actually the thing that's been kind of my preoccupation lately as a result of a class that I'm teaching at Cherokee Christian School with some seniors there, is this whole matter of, we'll just call it broadly, entertainment culture. We'll get to a little more specific conception in a moment. But obviously, it's not hard for us to understand that we live in an entertainment-saturated culture. It's just kind of the reality for us, and it's something that I think there's been plenty of information for years that's been available, plenty of teaching, even research that's been available for many years, to give us an indication of some of the dangers or pitfalls or perils of all forms and manner of entertainment. If you go back even to my younger days, which is about 1,000 years ago, some of you 2,000 as I'm looking out, you had the whole thing even in rock music. And do you remember, who knows what backward masking is? Ooh, we got a few old guys in here and some young that understand. There used to be this thing in the music industry and in Christian circles that, there were hidden messages in rock music that were devil-worshipping kinds of messages. And you had to take the record. Records are these round things, these discs, that somehow have music on them. But if you spin the record backwards, you can pick up on these satanic messages. So, you can go to any sort of generation and you can find sort of warnings or dangers, maybe some exaggerated, maybe some extreme for sure, around the perils, the pitfalls, the dangers of various forms of entertainment, particularly in a secular and corrupt society. But I want to focus more specifically on a more narrow view or understanding of entertainment or entertainment culture. And I want to turn to an author of a book. It's really a textbook. It's part of a curriculum entitled Understanding the Culture. It's about biblical worldview and cultural engagement. The author, Jeff Myers, draws a distinction between entertainment and amusement. And I think it's a really important and helpful distinction for us to think about as men who desire to be faithful in the Lord. He says this, derived from a Latin word meaning to keep people in a certain frame of mind, entertainment adds much joy to our lives. Increasingly, though, people find themselves trapped in a perpetual cycle of seeking amusement, which is an altogether different thing. Muse means to think. Ah means without. Amusement, then, is entertainment without thought. And so to think about amusement as opposed to just entertainment, I think, is the kind of distinction that helps us zero in on where the actual dangers and pitfalls lie. In fact, some of the older, the backward masking era version of cautioning young people against the dangers of secular entertainment, really the pendulum in that era, I think, in many ways, had swung in a really bad direction. We are called as believers to be salt and light, and we are called to be agents of redemption in the world. And that redemption work encompasses things like the arts and entertainment. And as this writer said, that entertainment is a means of enjoyment. If you go into the scriptures, you will find lots of references to the outward expressions of joyful entertainment and celebration all throughout scripture. Dancing and singing and music and arts and even even thinking about various architectural passages that deal with the building of things, building of important things like the temple, there is an artisanship, a craftsmanship, an artistic emphasis. And all these things can be a source of joy and a means of cultivating rich community and fellowship. And I think so it's important for us to make sure that we're drawing the right kind of distinction here and not sweeping everything pertaining to times of joyful entertainment under some kind of umbrella of sinful temptation. But I do think that this, even in the breakdown of the term amusement into its sort of core meaning of without thought, I think that's a helpful way for us to think about this, even just by its definition. In 1985, a little over 40 years ago, Neil Postman published his seminal work, Amusing Ourselves to Death. How many of you are familiar with that book title? Okay. Here's my 1986 publication. You'll notice it's a little brown around the edges. If you look into it, you can tell. It's funny to me how a book that came out in 1985, and this is the 1986 printing of it, that's like ancient in terms of current thoughts about time. But this does not represent some kind of ancient book. I've been to places and seen actual ancient books. This is just a little bit older. But in that book, Postman does this. It's almost prophetic. Actually, it is prophetic. It's a work that has to do with this whole matter of a shift from what he calls a typographic society to a more visual or image-based society. And he's talking about the transition to television, the ubiquitous advent of television in our culture and its effect on us, and how it has created a shift and moved us rapidly into the trivial and the absurd. And he actually, his research, he makes a very compelling and strong case about how the medium itself is the message. In other words, the way in which the medium works in and of itself is what cultivates this kind of debased, absurd sort of cultural outcome. In this work, he describes how our obsession with amusement hurts us, both personally and culturally. And in the opening chapters, he does this by using illustrations from two of the most probably famous dystopian works of literature that we could point to: George Orwell's 1984, and then Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. These two works that come at a dystopian future from two distinct angles. Orwell has this sort of theme of this dark, all-seeing, kind of big brother, tyrannical figure that takes control in a dystopian world. And in Huxley's Brave New World, he comes at this dystopian future from the angle of people, us, society, embracing oppression, welcoming a certain type of slavery, if you will, with the help of this fictional drug called Soma, which Huxley describes as having all the advantages of Christianity and alcohol with none of their defects. That's his way of describing this drug that brings about this willing embracing of enslavement and oppression. And here's how Neil Postman writes about this. He says, "What Orwell feared were those who would ban books. What Huxley feared was that there would be no one who wanted to read one. Orwell feared that the truth would be concealed from us. Huxley feared the truth would be drowned in a sea of irrelevance. Orwell feared we would become a captive culture. Huxley feared we would become a trivial culture. In short, Orwell feared that what we hate will ruin us. Huxley feared that what we love will ruin us. We love amusement, and it is ruining us. We are living in a day and a time when not only do we as believers, as brothers in the Lord, not only do we need to be mindful of the snares and temptations and pitfalls that could entrap us, that could render us ineffective for the gospel, that could have devastating impact to our witness and our testimony in our workplace and our calling as men in the home and leadership with our families. Not only could it have that effect, but it also might lead us, if we don't understand where we are in this whole matter of this amusement culture, we might not be adequately prepared for what lies ahead and how we might need to respond. Last week, Shane spent some time discussing this whole incident with the ICE protesters that crashed into a church on a Sunday morning time of worship and gave us some biblical insight about what the implications are of that kind of thing happening and what kind of response we should have. I think that it's important for us to realize that we may be at the very, very, very beginning of these kinds of things. Not because of some, you know, Trump derangement syndrome kind of concept. I'm talking about things that go back to this kind of forecasting. I'm talking about things that even go back before Postman's treatment on the matter. What I'm talking about is what happens when a society writ large is completely driven by and consumed by and shaped by its devotion to amusement, its addiction to amusement, its commitment to amusement. What happens to a society when that's the reality? Well, certainly, you know, we're seeing elements of that all the time. I'm sure you've found yourself at different points of time where you're hearing people in the public square, if you will, spouting off things that are just absolutely and utterly absurd. And you're looking around and you're saying, well, my goodness, these people are not alone. They've got a massive mob that's agreeing with them. And then you go a little bit further and you look and you go, man, they have entire organizations, well-funded, they're supporting their movement. And then you look around and you see corporations, Fortune 500, Fortune 50 companies who are advocating for the things that you heard them spout off originally and thought, that's absurd. And then you see advertising campaigns that support this absurdity and actually are doing very, very aggressive work to normalize the absurdity, to make everybody believe that this absurdity is what is not only normal, but virtuous, which is part of what Shane's point was last week about this protest effort. This is the world that we're living in, and it is pervasive, and the roots run deep, and it is only by the grace of God and the work of the gospel to bring light into darkness that will shift this tide, in my estimation. So I think that we not only need to be guarded as individuals against the snares and the claws that this can be for our own lives, but we need to be prepared to respond, to stand, to understand what we're seeing, and to know how to live faithfully in the midst of it all. It's a massive challenge. No small matter for us. Well, just to kind of flood the zone a little bit in this whole area, let's talk about for a moment. Let's kind of, and some of these data points you're familiar with. If you're not familiar with the most recent statistical numbers, you're certainly familiar with what the numbers represent. But I want to just kind of make sure I set the table properly with some data points. I'm just going to flood the zone with some information for a minute. Obviously, in an amusement-saturated culture, entertainment and distraction dominates daily life. That's just one effect that we all see and even experience in our own lives. But this often happens at the expense of deeper levels of human engagement, at the expense of people's actual state of mind. It has a cost to relationships, to productivity. And so I want to give us some statistical points that sort of support this premise. An estimated 210 million people worldwide show signs of addiction. In the U.S., that translates to about 10% of adults. Addiction to social media. I'm sorry, I left that part out. Addiction to social media. Among U.S. teens, 45% say they spend too much time on social media. And this is up from 36% in 2022. And nearly half believe it has a mostly negative effect on peers their age. About 1 in 5 teens report that their use has harmed their mental health or school performance. So this is obvious. We know this has a devastating effect on certainly young people, but adults as well. Video gaming. Global prevalence of gaming disorder stands at about 3% of gamers, about 60 million people, this gaming disorder. By the way, I don't know if you knew that there was a thing called gaming disorder. I just learned that recently, whatever that means. Rising to 8.5% among adolescents and 10.4% among young adults. In the U.S., estimates range from 1.7 to 10% of the population meeting clinical criteria for video game addiction, with higher rates among younger cohorts. Problematic gaming is strongly linked to reduced social activity in 70% of cases, sleep disturbance in 68% of cases, family withdrawal in 61%, and academic occupational impairment in 62%. Then you get to streaming and video consumption. U.S. households now spend nearly 5 hours per day streaming across services, an all-time high. Streaming hours up 6% year over year, and connected TV households reaching 96.4 million. I think what is interesting about this data, by the way, is that there is an exponential growth. Like the year over year data is just like it's escalating and expanding substantially in all these various categories. Streaming now represents about 45% of all TV viewing in the United States. Netflix alone accounts for over 1 hour per day among its active U.S. users. The average consumer spends about 1 hour and 22 minutes daily on streaming services. Pornography. Self-reported pornography addiction is about 11% of U.S. men and 3% of U.S. women. Lifetime exposure. Before age 18, about 70% of males and 40% of females. Average first exposure age is 10 for boys and 13 for girls. I mean, we all know, right, that what that does to a young mind, a prepubescent mind. Here's the sad reality. In some of my work with high school students, I mean, by the time they're seniors, you're just assuming that they're awash in pornography, if not in active exposure, certainly in memory and in recent memory. Like, their minds are shaped by graphic depictions of aberrant sexuality. And this is amongst young people in our churches. I mean, we're talking, it's massive. This is the world that we're living in. And it's not about entertainment, and it's not even about sexual satisfaction. It is about amusement. It is about not thinking. It is about giving up critical evaluation or assessment about what you're engaging in. It's losing yourself to the medium. Screen time, just the broader sense of things, U.S. teens with over 4 hours a day of screen time, of non-schoolwork screen time, I should specify. And this shows these elevated risks, depression symptoms up 25%, anxiety symptoms increased over time, infrequent physical activity, of course. It's hard to play basketball when you're sitting in front of a screen, right? Irregular sleep, weight concerns. I mean, on and on it goes. I mean, you could just kind of point out data. You've got, you know, childhood obesity problems in our country. You've got, you know, young people no longer getting married and waiting to get married. I mean, you've got all these different societal things, and we're going, what's going on with that? And some people say, well, it's economic, and you point to all these different things. I would say that much of it stems back to we are awash in an amusement culture. And it's having all kinds of effects on the way we think about life and social interaction, the way we care for or don't care for our bodies. And it's having a massive impact on just normal socialization, on marriage stability, on family dynamics. U.S. adults in the top 25% of social media usage frequency are more than twice as likely to report loneliness compared to the bottom 25%. Among teens, 31% say social media makes them feel excluded by friends. 39% feel overwhelmed by drama. 70% of teenagers report feelings of loneliness or exclusion due to social media. Obviously, the pornography has grave effects on marriages. Lower stability, 45%. Lower commitment, 30%. On and it goes. Screen time. Toddlers with higher screen time have significantly fewer back and forth conversations with parents. Parents report spending about 96 hours per year arguing with children over screen time, disrupting meals, bedtime, and daily routines. So just, I mean, start breaking all this down. So what's happening in homes is that parents are fighting with their kids over screen time more than they are engaging with them or teaching them or just enjoying a meal together. Like, that's what's happening. And I'm telling you, you start talking to young people and they'll verify this over and over again. I've got students that I'm talking to that will admit it's a problem. I mean, they'll admit to, you know, punching holes in their walls in their room over some stupid game, like some gaming situation or whatever. It has an effect on them. Pathological gaming in parents is, this is a funny statement to me. It's sad, but it's funny. Listen just the way this reads. Pathological gaming, that's how it starts. Pathological gaming in parents is directly linked to lower parental efficacy. You think? Higher parenting stress and increased depressive symptoms, which in turn worsen perceived parenting competence and family impact. Spouses of individuals with gaming problems frequently cite neglected household duties, withdrawal from family events, reduced sexual intimacy, and relationship conflict as major harms. So, on and on and on and on it goes, right? I mean, I'm flooding the zone. I'm just kind of trying to make us all feel appropriately bad about the situation, okay? We know these things generally. We certainly observe them anecdotally, and we probably have some level of exposure to this similar statistical data, okay? I'm not saying anything that we're not sort of mindful of or aware of. I think the real question for us, or a question for us, is, does a fish know that it's wet? Are we in the water? I think that even with this reading of these statistics, we can sort of, in a sense, know that we're in the water. But are we conscious of the actual effects that all of this might be having on us, to dull us, to weaken us, to distract us? The subtleties of the effects cannot be overemphasized. I'm saying this as a point of confession, not exhortation. The ways in which our lives and our thinking and our moods and our energy and our sleep and everything else you can possibly conceive of that would either lend itself to or take away from our overall well-being, including our outlook, our clarity, our ability to focus, our ability to think and meditate on truth, all of these things, the effects are all the time and everywhere. And it's a massive challenge for us as men. I think that the challenge is particularly poignant for younger generations, for sure. At least those of us who are a little bit older have a reference point of a different day, you know, a different way of things, a different way of interacting, different ways of entertainment or enjoying time together. At least we have that reference point. You know, we remember telephones that were mounted to a wall and had cords on them and stuff like that. You know, we remember these things. We have that as a reference point. But younger people today have no reference point to anything else. They are growing up in what, this is normal. This is just how it is. And so, what does normal look like? How do we need to think about this normal? Well, because I am a man of the contemporary age, I decided to consult Grok on this. I put in a Grok AI prompt that says this: if Netflix was a person and its current catalog of movies and TV shows was its mind, how would you summarize Netflix's worldview? Netflix is the largest streaming platform, about 325 million subscribers. That's almost the population of the United States, if you're wondering. It's the second largest content catalog behind Amazon Prime, so it's got one of the largest content catalogs as well. So I just thought, if I want to understand what the ubiquitous worldview influence is, Netflix is a good profile. Here's how Grok summarized the worldview of this perceived person, Netflix. At its core, Netflix believes the world is complicated, interconnected, and worth exploring from every angle. No single perspective owns the truth. It sees humanity as driven by intense relationships, familial bonds, toxic romances, lifelong friendships, betrayals that reveal who we really are under pressure. Love, loyalty, and identity are recurring obsessions, whether in sweeping historical romances like Bridgerton, high-stakes thrillers, or intimate character studies. It embraces diversity as both moral good and smart storytelling fuel. Not always perfectly, but consistently more than many competitors. The catalog champions underrepresented voices, global narratives, and then it has in parentheses K-dramas, telenovelas, Nollywood, Spanish language hits, so very global. And intersectional identities, gender parity in leads, strong showings for people of color in key roles, growing LGBTQ plus visibility. This reflects a worldview that says the more lenses we use, the clearer and more entertaining reality becomes. The more lenses we use, the clearer and more entertaining reality becomes. Netflix is thrilled by the strange and the speculative. It loves worlds where the impossible crashes into the everyday. Supernatural nostalgia, dystopian games, sci-fi mind benders, demon-hunting K-pop stars. And then it references a show called K-pop Demon Hunters. Now, I read this to my students, and they all knew that show. So you guys need to catch up. You need to check out K-pop Demon Hunters on Netflix. You know what hit me about that? It's a kids show. It's a kids show. Now, I don't even need to know anything else about it other than the title to know that at minimum, it is seeking to trivialize any kind of truth-based thought in children. It is seeking to just completely draw them away from any kind of critical thought. Content may even be much worse than that in terms of what it's leading them to or plant seeds it's planting. But yeah, K-pop Demon Hunters, check it out on Netflix. Apocalyptic threats. The future is uncertain. Technology, alien forces are scary, but human connection, cleverness, and sheer stubbornness usually win out. It doesn't preach doom, it finds wonder in the chaos. Morally, it's relativist with a soft progressive tilt, you think? Villains get nuance. Anti-heroes thrive, and good versus evil rarely stays binary. It questions power, critiques society, but ultimately affirms personal agency, redemption arcs, and found family. Evil exists, but people can change, or at least entertain us trying. It has a hedonistic, escapist streak. Binge-worthy comfort food, pure fun, and high-gloss spectacle along prestige dramas. Life is hard, so why not indulge in deception you enjoy, family drama you crave, or old friends in new lights? In short, Netflix the person would be that endlessly curious, slightly chaotic friend who believes everyone has a story worth hearing, especially if it's messy, multicultural, or supernatural. Emotions are far more important than ideology. The world is dark, weird, and beautiful, and we're all just trying to find love, belonging, or a good fight in it. Tomorrow could be anything, so let's keep discovering. Now, as I read that, I thought, well, that's fascinating, actually. That's a fascinating take on if Netflix was a person and you tried to kind of pinpoint what that person's worldview would be. And you'll notice that it is vast, it is untamed, it attributes a nobility and a virtue to unrestrained exploration, that every story is worth hearing and telling. It's all a part of the beautiful, chaotic mess that is our human experience. This is an entire amusement, entertainment environment in which this kind of very subtle, yet overwhelmingly powerful ideology and messaging is being promoted. This is the world that people are living in. People binge watch certain types of shows, and they emote through them and gain some type of buzz or satisfaction, and it is a distraction from the mundaneness or even misery of their actual real lives. And so they further withdraw into this amusement kind of world. And this amusement kind of world is sending them all these kinds of messages. It's putting forward these kinds of values as virtue. That's what it's doing. Now again, I'm not coming up here to say don't ever watch Netflix. I hope you're hearing me correctly. I'm not saying we need to cloister ourselves on some kind of tower in the desert and just sort of slap ourselves on the back with some kind of whip. I'm not advocating, you know, some modern form of monasticism. I'm merely making the point that the worldview that we are immersed in as a society is this. It just is. And the fact of the matter is that we are actually immersed in it. And it's all around us. And as I thought about this particular worldview exercise surrounding Netflix, I also thought about C.S. Lewis's The Screwtape Letters. How many of you are familiar with The Screwtape Letters? Okay, good. Just to kind of summarize it quickly, it's obviously C.S. Lewis's work, and it's written in the form of letters written from Uncle Screwtape, who is sort of a master demon tempter, to his nephew, Wormwood, who has been assigned as the principal tempter of a man, a British man they refer to as the patient. And so you have each chapter in the form of a letter that's being written by Uncle Screwtape advising Wormwood how to be most effective at tempting the patient, tempting them away from anything that would lead them to the enemy who is God. And I couldn't help but think how this is actually the machinations of demonic strategy at work. Compel people to at least be riddled with a sense of ambiguity about the nature of objective truth. At least be riddled with that ambiguity. It's just too hard to know. It's just murky. I'm not going to outright say there is no objective truth. I mean, that would actually be an objective truth claim in of itself. I know that. I took philosophy in college, right? I'm not going to do that, but what I can say is that what you have to admit is that it's ambiguous. There's not clarity. And the world is chaotic. And people are messy. And so that's just sort of the world that we live in. And by the way, my time here that I spend is really just a way for me to unwind. I mean, life's hard, and my work is hard, and my job is stressful. And so me engaging in this sort of form of amusement, it's not that I'm addicted, or it's not that it's harmful, or it's not that it's excessive. It's just a way for me to kind of blow off some steam. And we're just not conscious. We're not thinking about the impact. We're not intentional about the time. We're not aware of how this is sort of kind of permeating us and at least dulling us. Now, we are very fortunate, as I thought about this as well, we are very fortunate here in this church in particular, where you have to train yourself to pay attention if you're going to get anything out of your time here. The teaching times are not quick and short. They're not oriented around, you know, short attention spans. We actually compel parents to start bringing their children into the worship service by age 4 so they can be trained, knowing that bringing them in at age 4 is a disaster for a while for many of them. I mean, I'll never forget, when we moved here from Southern California, our son was 4 years old, and we were like, we moved here from, you know, nursery Brandon to worship service Brandon like that, and we were like, you've got to be kidding me. But you know what? That he learned, he got trained, we figured it out, struggled and didn't know what we were doing and felt like, you know, everybody was looking at us and all those kinds of things that parents go through, right? But think about what that does for a young person and a child as they're developing. They're having to learn. This is what we do here. This is how you need to, like, you can do this. It is possible to do this. So we're very fortunate in our environment and just the way that we function here and the priority we place upon the sort of the careful exposition of Scripture and taking time to establish context and all of these important matters. But most of the world, even in the Christian world, is not like this at all. And so at least I would say our capacity for discernment and our probably our quicker distaste or even self-awareness of, man, I got to stop, this is too much. You know, I think that the levels of sensitivity are probably heightened more, across the board more generally for us. So we need to be very grateful for that. But the world that we're living in is this kind of world, even amongst confessing Christians. And I would say that in many respects, even amongst Christians, they're in pointed ways playing right into the enemy's hands. And they're not even necessarily cognizant of it. And to talk in these ways, what the message that is immediately heard, which is an indication of the veracity of some of the things I'm saying, the message that you often hear is a message of resistance. By going to the extreme. Are you saying we can't play any games? Are you saying gaming's bad? Is that what you're saying? Are you saying we shouldn't watch any secular movies? Or if we do, it has to be old Disney. You can't even watch new Disney, right? It has to be old Disney, right? Pre-woke Disney or whatever. I mean, is that what you're saying? You know, you get this response. It's like it's a resistance response. That's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying I watch shows on Netflix. I'm saying I'm in the soup with you. I'm saying we're all in the soup, and we need to be intentional about what it is that we're in and what it is that everyone around us is in and what kind of effects it's having on us and having on them and what are some of the more extrapolated societal implications for it that we're seeing demonstrated over and over and over again. You go through the sort of the pandemic period, and what happened to many, 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 many churches? We have people in our church today, probably in this room, who came to us because their church went sideways during that period of time. They drifted in their convictions in meaningful ways. And we're adopting what is nothing other than secular worldview and ideology and applying it and actually deploying it, even weaponizing it in the church against congregants. That's what happened during that period of time. We look at that and we're like, what happened? How'd that happen? Well, this is what's happening. This is where we are. We need to be prepared for this kind of reality, possibly even to continue. And we need to be thinking about what defenses we need to have up, but also what offenses we need to have in play. And I would just want to close. I know I haven't gone to the Scriptures, and so I want to go to the Scriptures for a moment. I appreciate the opportunity to just sort of sound some of these things out with you and just prompt our thinking a little bit here. But I want to just kind of reference what is probably one of the more familiar passages of Scripture to most of us, I'm guessing. Certainly in the New Testament, in Romans chapter 12. Just backing up just a little bit, though. As you know, I'm sure many of you know, Romans is this theological treatise by the Apostle Paul. The work of God in Christ, justification, even the implications of the new covenant in the gospel as it pertains to his own people, the nation of Israel, the people of Israel. And you get to the end of chapter 11, and it begins to make a turn to, okay, so what do we do about this? How should we live in light of these truths? But if you back up before you get to Romans chapter 12, you have this incredible sort of doxology that the Apostle Paul states in sort of response to this amazing reality of God's redemptive purposes, both for the Gentiles and for the Jews. In verse 33 of chapter 11, he says, "Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments, and how inscrutable his ways. For who has known the mind of the Lord, or who has been his counselor? Or who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid? For from him, and through him, and to him are all things. To him be glory forever. Amen." This comprehensive statement, which the Apostle Paul says this on multiple occasions, something similar to this on multiple occasions. But this principle of for from him and through him and to him are all things, to him be glory forever. This is the point for us. He would say it another way, in a sense, in 1 Corinthians, in a hedonistic culture, whether you eat or whether you drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. So whether you watch this or play that, whether you go here and engage in this form of entertainment or that form of entertainment, what you are doing before the Lord. Because from him and through him and to him are all things. It's about awareness and intentionality and mindset. You can think about the study in 1 Peter and being sober-minded and alert, recognizing that there is an adversary. It's those kinds of truths that are our preoccupation. But you come here to Romans chapter 12 as he transitions into what you might refer to as the practical implications and applications of this amazing New Covenant doctrine. And he says in chapter 12, verse 1, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice." Of course, that's what you would do. If you understand that for him and through him and to him are all things, to him be the glory forever, the only reasonable response is to present your bodies, everything that you are, your being, your person, your physical frame, your mind, body, soul, all that you are, as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. And then he gives this practical sort of warning. Do not be conformed to this world. Do not be shaped by this world. But be transformed. Be remade by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. That's what we're after here. I'm not advocating a complete, you know, dry dock for everything, every form of media and entertainment that you now enjoy. Just set it all aside. That is your spiritual form of worship. That's not what the text says. That's not what it's implying. It's talking about who we are and what we do before we put the screen up in front of us. It's talking about us giving ourselves daily, repeatedly, consistently, giving ourselves over as this living sacrifice, and then being watchful, being warned about the possibility, even the likelihood, if we're not giving ourselves over in daily sacrifice, of being pressed in and shaped into the mold of this world. That is what happens. That is what will happen. This is what the Apostle Paul is saying. This whole body of doctrine, just reading it and having the truths of it kind of wash over you, is not a safeguard against being conformed to this world. Otherwise, the Spirit would have inspired him to caution believers about this. Just having an acquiescence, an intellectual acquiescence, or even a firm, full-throated agreement with all the doctrinal truths that he just laid out is not the safeguard against this kind of conformity. The Apostle Paul knows you are in an environment in which this will press you down and shape you if you were not living before the Lord daily as a living sacrifice to Him. Don't be conformed, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern. And in all these studies, in fact, one reference that I read talked about the absence of discernment. It actually employed biblical terminology, if you will, a biblical concept, to articulate what has so incredibly diminished, sort of society-wide. It's the diminishment of discernment, of the ability to discern, as he says here, what is good and acceptable and perfect, complete, full. This is what we're called to. This is what we are challenged to submit to. This is what forms for us a safeguard against laxity, against default habits, against being conformed and being shaped by Netflix, this worldview that's just pervasive, and to embracing a shade of entertainment that is more about not thinking than it is about enjoying the provision of the Lord for art and beauty and storytelling and the things that inspire us or challenge us or provoke our thinking or give us opportunity to enjoy communal fellowship together. It's more about just checking out and numbing ourselves. And this is what this cautions us against. We have to be intentional. We have to be living before the Lord as a sacrifice to Him. And we have to have our minds renewed so that we can discern. We can see, we can test, and we can understand and know that which is good and acceptable and perfect, and we can walk in that. That's what we're called to, and that's what we need to be challenged by. That's all I have. Any final thoughts or comments before we pray and are dismissed? Yeah, I agree, and I think that's the hard part. I think that is the hard part, because there is time and exposure is a thing, just on a very practical level. It's almost like, what's the first step to, you know, being free from an addiction? Well, somehow you got to stop doing the thing that you're addicted to. It's like, somehow there's got to be a change in your habit, in your pattern. So, yeah, it's a very, very difficult, exercise for us to really think through and wrestle with what this means for us and what are the practical steps we need to take. And again, I chose Netflix simply because it's the largest provider. I mean, just pick the other, I mean, it's just an example. Pick any of the others. I just saw it as the largest, and so I chose it. You could choose any one of them, really. It just has to do with the world that we live in, and actually, it's just an indication of what has been determined as what the content of entertainment. It bends this way; it just does, and we know that. But we're much more consumed and subsumed in it than probably in past times. So, all right. Thank you for your time, guys. Good to be with you. Have